Welcome to CrimeWire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts, along with noted crime consultants and attorneys often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, and Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there on top of the crime at the top of their game. CrimeWire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in any time during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send the CrimeWire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or want to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. As you know, our friend and Denny's co-host, Susan Murphy Milano, has been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer and will be off for the next several weeks while she undergoes treatment. You can show your support for Susan and keep up with her progress by visiting her site at http://www.conqueringcancer.me. Denny is on vacation. I'm pleased to have Peter Hyatt as my co-host tonight. Peter, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So we're going to talk about the Haley Dunn case tonight. And Haley went missing, and she's 13, and she went missing on December 27, 2010. She was allegedly walking to a friend's house in broad daylight in Colorado City, Texas. She was reported missing by her mother, Billie Jean Dunn. The case quickly turned bizarre with accusation of drugs, child porn, failed polygraphs, and Haley's mother, Billie Jean Dunn, being named a person of interest in her daughter's disappearance, along with her live-in boyfriend. Peter, you want to take it?
I do. The case has obviously in the mind of the public, mine included, has gone cold. There's been no news on it for quite some time. In March, a body was discovered in that area that I thought was Haley's. I thought they had found her, and some of the locals on the scene had reported items that appeared to be a girl's clothing, that sort of thing, was on at the remains, but it turned out to be false. It was not Haley. So she continues to remain missing. But the reason that the case is now picking up is because, we'll take it from the beginning, but just a few weeks ago, I had received some transcripts of Facebook transmissions in which the mother of Haley Dunn was seeking media attention once again, which was something that was surprising because she had really had sought it out greatly in the beginning and then ran off when the heat got up there. But now she's looking back for the media attention, and she's doing it in a very unusual way. What she's doing is she has a small group of a couple of women supporters who are very emotionally attached and bonded to her, and she is claiming that she's not with the boyfriend, Sean Atkins, any longer, but she's actually afraid of him, and he's a danger to her, that sort of thing. And I don't buy it. I don't believe it. And I think that the listeners will probably have quite a few doubts themselves regarding Billie Dunn's veracity, and here's why. If we look at this case from the beginning, one of the things about statement analysis that we do is we ask people just to listen and not to interpret. Just listen and let the person's words guide you. Don't interpret what they say. Just listen. Mm-hmm. And so just to back it up, at the end of December of 2010, a 13-year-old girl was reported missing by her mother, who called the police and went by the police station and reported her missing. About a week or so later, I think it was January 3rd, she appeared on the Nancy Grace show, and this is where I first heard of the case. And this is where we ask listeners to just listen to the mother, listen with an open mind. In fact, presuppose that the mother is going to tell us the truth. Presuppose that we're going to have a brokenhearted mother who is going to come and plead for her daughter's return because her daughter is missing. We must begin, anyone who does this type of work must begin with a prejudiced view, and the prejudice must lie on the side of innocence. And it's not an ethical or moral decision. It's how liars are caught. If we have an expectation of being told the truth, we then leave ourselves open to be surprised when we don't hear the truth. It's that surprise itself, and I put surprise in quotes, that allows us to know that we are being lied to. It's like an alarm system that we go off. But the only way to set the alarm, the only way to hear any noise, is bring the level down to zero. And if any noise hits the radar, we'll pick it up. If our suspicions are high and we think that the mother is ignorant or bad or she must be involved in some reason, it'll cause our own thinking, our own radar system, to be off basis. We want to think like this, and this is, it's really as behavioral analysis does it too. What would you do if your child was missing? And we ask people to consider that. Guilty people will say, there is no book on that sort of thing. There's no handbook. There's no directions. And that's a very good point. There isn't. There isn't a book on those things because we don't need them. It's instinct. A parent's instinct is to find a child. So if the first instinct that a parent has when a child is missing is to not search for the child and not cry out for the child, something is very, very wrong. And therefore, a book has been written. The book is not so much in a book form, but is a massive bounds of research, literature that suggests what behavior is guilty, what behavior is innocent. And as you can imagine, if you picture yourself walking at a supermarket with your three-year-old and you're holding your three-year-old's hand and you become distracted, drop the hand, turn around and the three-year-old is missing, there is a reaction that we would say is appropriate and innocent, and there's a reaction that's guilty. If you lost your three-year-old, looked around, didn't see her, and decided to go off and keep shopping or then maybe go in the car and drive home, something is very, very wrong. If you stop and begin to call for her name and go into an instant panic mode, it's an innocent type of reaction. So it is really based on common sense. So as we move forward in our thinking, we jump to January 3rd, about a week later, and we listen to a mother plead for her daughter's safety and her safe return on the Nancy Grace Show. We must begin thinking that the mother, her name is Billie Jean Dunn, is going to tell the truth and is going to plead for her daughter. So Nancy Grace has Mark Kloss on, for instance, and others who comment on these type of things, and lawyers are on it. Generally, a psychotherapist or two will be on it to gauge reaction. And what happens typically is that a mother comes on and she's upset and she speaks about her child missing, and the psychotherapist will say, I can tell that she's sincere, and the lawyers will say, but she should never take a polygraph. And everyone has their own little niches and places in this drama. And Nancy Grace plays a split role, almost a schizophrenic role, where on one side, she is the host, and it's her job to build ratings. So she needs the mother to come back on the show if the mother's interesting. But the other side of her is a prosecutor who likes to ask questions. And as she asks questions, if she hears something that sounds less than truthful, she'll ask a follow-up question. And this is what happened with Billie Jean Dunn. She appeared on the show 10 times, nine or 10 times, kept coming back. No matter how brutal it was, she kept coming back. And at one point, the viewers of the program had to decide, did she keep returning because she's innocent and she's just being maligned by people, or is she guilty, deceptive, and having a need to control the information? And what happens is that if we speak long enough, a psychological profile will emerge from our words that'll tell people who we are and what we believe and what we're like. So what we're expecting to hear when she appears on the show is for her to tell what happened and to plead for her daughter's return. And we expect someone to be truthful and to be hurting and to be genuine. Now, I'm not a body language expert. I don't pretend to be. I disagree with those that say that so-and-so has real tears versus crocodile tears, because people can cry for a variety of reasons, and they can bring up tears for while they're considering some sad thing in life if they're about to fool people, for instance. I've known people to cry on Will. I was raised with seven sisters. I've seen these things. I get a kick out of the analyst and the psychotherapist who will immediately declare someone to be truthful or honest, even as things are going by that are making no sense. But would it be okay to start right with the beginning of her appearance?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Definitely.
Okay. Nancy Grace introduces to the people that a 13-year-old cheerleader leaves in broad daylight from her own home to walk down the street to a little friend's sleepover. She said, it reminds me a lot of the Carly Bucia, if I'm saying that correctly, if I'm mispronouncing it, I apologize, the Carly Bucia case out of Florida, where she's never seen again. The Carly Bucia case was a young girl was going to a sleepover at her friend's house, and she wasn't seen again, and she was kidnapped and murdered. And this is really interesting that Nancy Grace said the story sounds the same. And so listeners should keep that in mind, that in introducing this mother, she brought up another case that is from the True Crime Library of which Nancy Grace was associated with. That it reminds her of that. So that's the first thing we see. Then she goes to a news reporter who gives a story that we've all heard, that supposedly she was last seen at 3 o'clock on a Monday, and she was going to sleep over at her friend's house. She told her mother's live-in boyfriend, tell my mom I'm sleeping over, and left without any of her belongings whatsoever. So that's kind of strange, because 13-year-old girls are really attached to their stuff. 13-year-old boys are as well, but especially 13-year-old girls, they love to have their stuff. They have their toothpaste.
That is so true.
They love their stuff. They have a special jacket. They have a special pillow. They have a special this or that. Or a little pocketbook with tons and tons of stuff. So that's kind of strange, but they also chose that the last time she was seen was 3 o'clock. Now, that grabs me because research has shown that when someone is going to make up a number in a fabrication from 0 to 9, they will often choose the number 3. When I was on the program last week, we talked about the fake hate crime of Charlie Rogers, where the men broke into her home with masked men and they beat her and allegedly carved into her flesh.
Yes.
Yeah, and she ended up being arrested for making a false report. Do you remember how many men it was?
Three.
Three men. It was three men. The Mark McCliff, in his research, he had asked students and others throughout law enforcement around the country to keep an eye on this. And every time you hear someone report something 3, like 3 o'clock, three men on the third floor on 3rd Street, just make a note of it, because certainly three men can rob somebody at 3 o'clock on 3rd Street on the third floor. But it seems that when people are going to make up a number, other than when they're asked, how many drinks did you have, sir? They say, 2, officer. But when someone's going to invent a number, they lean psychologically, for some reason, to the number 3. Tiffany Hartley, who reported her husband David Hartley missing, she came back and said, we just had 3 boats chasing us. Interesting number 3. There was another fake hate crime where a young guy said that he was beaten up and bruised, and they said, how many people attacked you? He said, 3 men attacked me. And later on, he was seen on video doing jumping jacks and backflips and things, and he bruised his own face. So the number 3 is a red flag, but still, we want to consider that this mother is telling us the truth, and what we want to hear is from the mother. So Nancy Grace introduces her. This is the first time the nation is seeing or hearing from Billie Jean Dunn about the 13-year-old girl. And as Nancy Grace tells the story of how she went She said, "Miss Dunn, how far did she, being Haley, have to go get to the sleepover?" So the question is, how far did she have to go? Now I give you the very first words out of the mouth of the mother of a missing 13-year-old girl. This is what she says. Four or five blocks. And that is a good answer. She's answering the question, how far did she have to go? Four or five blocks. With Billy Dunn, it's never enough for her to give a short answer. She gets herself in trouble because she continues to speak afterwards. And she did. The next sentence out of her mouth, four or five blocks, there is no linguistic problem with that. She said, it wasn't rare for Haley to walk a short distance during daylight. She wasn't allowed out after dark, especially to walk, but she only had four or five blocks to go. And as I was watching that, my wife Heather looked over at me and said, did you hear that? I said, no, what was that? She goes, did you hear that? She referenced her daughter in the past tense.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and I said, no, not another one of these cases. I don't want to hear another one. When a child is missing, a mother who, even just once or twice, slips into the past tense is giving us an indication that she either knows or believes the child is dead. Susan Smith did it. Casey Anthony did it. Misty Croslin, stepmother of Haley Cummings, did it. They slip into the past tense because they have either knowledge or belief. So the first thing we say is, have the police told the mother anything that would indicate the child is dead? And at this time, all we've heard is that the police may believe it's a runaway. And a mother's natural instinct is not to accept the child is dead. And in fact, if we listen to June 4th of 2 years ago, I think it was, when Kyron Hallman went missing, his mother Desiree Young spoke, and he's dead, and it's something that we've known, and we know whose hand he's dead by, and the stepmother, and she still can't accept it. It can't be. There's been cases where a child was missing and found dead, shown to the mother would grab the child and begin to rub the child's body and speak to the child in terms of endearment, but in the present tense. It's a natural maternal instinct not to accept death. So Deborah Bradley, missing baby Lisa, another interesting case, she referenced her child in the past tense. Rebecca and Sergio Chellis, of missing six-year-old Isabel Chellis, that was the one with the silly 911 call where he was giggling.
Yep. Yes.
They referenced their daughter in the past tense.
They did.
I've known people who were not able to reference their pets in the past tense.
Yes, that's true.
Due attachment. So my attention now was, at that point, it was divided. I'm usually, if I'm watching television with Heather, she's usually doing one thing, I'm usually doing another, and the TV's on the background. Now my attention was fully on the mother. And at this point, for me as an analyst, I took out a pen and paper and began to write down what she said because it bothered me. Once she referenced the child in the past tense and she's able to even accept it for whatever's going on is a terribly, terribly large sign, a red flag that she knows or believes the child is dead. So now I've heard the unexpected. I was expecting the mother to speak in terms of glowing terms and present tense language and not accepting anything other than hope. And the first thing I'm hearing is the mother went beyond the question, how far did she go, which is usually unusual. It should be considered unusual. Mm-hmm. And she spoke of her in the past tense. And so now I have a belief or an inkling, like so many others, baby Isla, baby Lisa, list goes on and on, that Haley is dead. Then Nancy Grace spoke again, and they run to some videos, they come back. And then Nancy Grace asked what I consider the magic question. The best question that you can ask someone as an interviewer is not always the best question for ratings, but is the best question for information. what happened. And then when they're done, say, what happened next? Those two magical questions bring in the most amount of information. Whatever information they give, we'll ask questions on that. It doesn't go over well because commentators like to ask compound questions because they're able to talk a lot, and the show is supposed to be about them. It's named after her, so she's going to want to talk it up. But in a compound question, we give the subject of the interview the ability to pick and choose which question they would like to answer, and that's a mistake. But in this case, Nancy Grace started off really well, and she asked her what happened. Now, one of the best parts about what happened, and this is known to skillful therapists, is it allows the person, the subject, to begin the answer wherever he or she wishes to begin. We know that the first sentence is going to be important. In statement analysis, we say the first statement sets a priority. This will tell us what the mother's priority is by what her answer is. And so if someone were to ask me what happened, my daughter went missing, and then I would tell them the thing, but my daughter would be first, and it's expected. So she can choose to begin where she wants to. We're going to listen very carefully to her answer. We know that when someone says what happened, that whatever words she chooses are going to be her own. They're not going to be from the interviewer. So that's another thing. We're going into the free editing process, really trustworthy. And this is what she said. The question is, what happened? Her answer began with this. She went missing on Monday night while I was at work. I'm sorry. She went missing on Monday while I was at work. So in my notebook, I wrote alibi building.
Yes. Right.
The priority is the mother herself to make sure. She didn't ask you when did she go missing. She's what happened.
Right.
She went missing while I was at work.
Yeah, she's building an alibi. She's wanting to throw that in there. I was at work, by the way.
Yeah. But it's also the first sentence from her mouth about what happened. So she's choosing to begin the story with an alibi. So in two short questions, I now know the child is dead and the mother needs an alibi. Just in the first few minutes of the program.
Yep.
It gets worse. She went missing while I was at work. My boyfriend, he came home from work about 3, or he got to my house around 3, and he seen Haley. Haley was there. She told him, I'm running across the street to my dad's house for a few minutes, but then I'm going to Marybeth's, and I'm staying the night. Let my mom know. So that evening, when he came to pick me up from work, we got home. I better back up a little bit, because it really, this one answer to one question tells us almost everything we need to know about this case. So the question is, what happened? Not when did it happen, what happened? She answers it with when. She went missing while I was at work. We have technically a question that we consider now sensitive to her.
Mm-hmm.
If I ask you a question and you don't answer the question, that means the question is sensitive to you. So if I say, are you throwing a birthday party for me tonight? And you avoid answering, I think there might be a birthday party going on for me tonight. It's something that minor. What time do you get to work today? And the person talks all around, and they don't answer the question. Did you steal money from your employer today? If the person doesn't answer the question, there's a reason why they don't answer the question. This is what we call sensitivity. It's a sensitivity indicator. As an analyst puts together the sensitivity indicators, he's able to discern whether deception exists or not. So now I have a strong indication that something about what happened is very wrong here, that the child, whatever happened, the child is dead, and mom needs an alibi. Then she said, my boyfriend, he came home from work about 3. So I heard her introduce my boyfriend without a name. That tells me that when the name is not introduced, there may be a problem in that relationship. yes, she takes ownership of him with the possessive pronoun my. We are, as human beings, very possessive creatures. My husband, mm-hmm. my wife, you know, my telephone, my computer, my team, my favorite team. We take possession of things that are ours. She takes possession of him, but this is called an incomplete social introduction. It's incomplete. She doesn't tell us his name. So now, in my analyst mode, I got a baby that's dead, a child that's dead. I've got a mother needing an alibi, and I've got a relationship with a boyfriend that is already red flagged. And she's but said two sentences at this point. This is how much people give themselves away.
Yeah.
We don't realize. I tell that story that the instructor tells, where he had an Israeli calligrapher at one of his classes, and she was, someewhat top at her craft as a calligrapher, and he was teaching the part about social introductions, and he said, in a statement, the way someone introduces somebody is very important, just as when the person's name arises. If the name arises early, the person's important. If the name is later on, it's less priority. But how we introduce someone in a statement is the same way we do in real life. So if I say, my wife, Heather, that would be a complete social introduction. I've taken possession of her, and I've given her
mm-hmm.
a name.
Mm-hmm.
If I simply say Heather to someone that doesn't know her, in my statement, I have deprived her of being my wife. Something is wrong.
Something's wrong.
Some people know this instinctively at singles bars. They're really good at picking up this type of language. And so if a woman says, oh, I'm here with my friends, I'm not here with my husband, Bob. My husband and Bob tells the person, you're not going to get very far with me. If some guy says about
mm-hmm.
his wife, calls her the wife, that is a good indication that he's probably looking, that sort of thing. Well, in this case, he was teaching this about social introductions, and over the years I've used this in HR disputes and everything else, where someone says, my supervisor, Bob, said I should do this. That's indication of a good relationship. The supervisor, without a name, is indication of tension. Well, she said, you know, I heard what you said about social introductions, and I love your training, but I don't like the notion of saying my husband. And she said to him, you know why? Because in Hebrew, the word husband is like the old English, Shakespearean English, for lord. Lowercase L.
Oh.
Yeah, husband means boss or lord of me, or from the Latin it would mean like a farmer husbanding his crops, that sort of thing. And she said, I'll tell you this, I am an independent woman, I am a feminist, and not just me, but my girlfriends, over my dead body would I call him my husband. There's no way I'll ever use that term. And so he said to her, human beings are possessive creatures. You don't get a pass for culture. You don't get a pass for being a feminist. Without a complete social introduction, we have a problem in the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, nope, I will never say it. So he said, well, why don't we just agree to disagree and we'll move on with the class. And they did.
Mm-hmm.
And later on at the end of the class, she was talking to him, and she was very excited about the notion of counting the number of words someone uses and dividing them per hour. It's kind of a neat thing that we do in analysis called lines per hour. And she was excited about that. And he said, well, you know, if you use, I don't know, Microsoft Word or something, you can do word counts right on the computer there really easy. And she said to him, oh, the computer, my husband's on that thing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, uh-oh. She said, what? He said, you said my husband.
Mm-hmm.
And the computer, that means before, bad relationship, it has something to do with the computer. And later on, one of her friends admitted that her husband was on the computer 24 hours a day, and he was having affairs with other women on the computer. So it kind of backfired on her. She made a big stance about not using the phrase, my husband, but
mm-hmm.
when it was in the pre-editing process and her emotions kicked in and she was angry, she called him my husband. So there is no past for culture.
Yeah, right.
In in this case, we have a mother who is introduced into the topic, a boyfriend, and he doesn't have a name. So right away, there is going to be a problem, and as it turned out, it certainly was a problem in this relationship. My boyfriend, he came home from work around 3, so we've noted that 3. Then she said, or he got to my house around 3.
Uh-huh.
So he came, this is kind of weird. She has a thing, it's called the either or. And what it does is it's like a hedging of a bet. If I tell you I did this or I did that, you might say, well, which one is it? I want to leave both up because later I can change my story. So the either or mentality is something that accomplished liars use. What I mean by an accomplished liar is someone who is nervous and lying and not good at it won't use these type of phrases. They'll lie badly and they'll get caught. Casey Anthony was an accomplished liar. She was
extremely
lying in childhood. Yeah. Because our speech is done in such a way that we use the same words over and over millions of times, these are habits. When we see an accomplished liar, it's a signal that the liar is not new at lying, and they're not in a new topic of lies, but they've been doing it since childhood.
Wow.
When it flows this easily with expressions. So, strange enough, why would she say he either got there or he got home from work at 3 o'clock? She's already hedging, and the either or stood out as a need to hedge, and we find out later on why she was doing this. With each one of these things that sounded weird, the next show or the show later, we found out why it was weird. That's what happens. So I've got a dead child, I've got a mother in need of an alibi, I've got a problematic relationship with a boyfriend, all coming together, 3 o'clock, and now she's using language like the either-or language, which is suggesting that she needs to hedge her bets. And he got to my house at 3 o'clock, or he got to my house at 3 o'clock, so one or the other. And then we have redundancy. This is another problem. She says, and he's seen Haley. Haley was there. If he saw her, she would have to be there. So there's no reason for her to make the second sentence. It sounds to the untrained ear to be awkward, because it is awkward. I went to the baseball game yesterday. I was there. Well, Peter, if you said you were at the baseball game, we believe you. Why do you need to repeat that you were there? Something's wrong. There's a need to make emphasis. So I have the either or, and now I have the emphasis. He's seen Haley. Haley was there. So he got to the house at 3, and he saw Haley. That should be enough. Then she adds in, Haley was there. She told him, I'm running across the street to my dad's house for a few minutes. I'm going to marry Bess and staying the night. Let my mom know. Well, there's another problem with that sentence as well. We look at communication language. If I said to you, you know, my boss asked me to be at work at 8 o'clock. You'd say, okay, you should probably make it to work at 8 o'clock. But if I said to you, my boss told me to be there at 8 o'clock, that has more authoritative feel to it. There's a little more tension there. Asked is soft, told is stronger.
Mm-hmm.
If I said I was walking down the road and 3 gentlemen with a gun asked me for my money, you would say something's wrong with the story. We have the number 3. We have a guy calling robbers gentlemen, and they have a gun, but they're asking for money? No, those SOBs demanded. They told me hand over the money. They'd use a stronger language.
Right.
So what I did at that point was I noted that a 13-year-old child appears to be telling off in authoritative terms where she's going to spend the night. But then she said, not tell my mom, but let my mom know. It's an inconsistency in language. It's not conclusively deceptive, but it may be deception. So I noted it as possible deception. Whether or not it was deceptive, but... Then she says, so, that evening, this is critical now. If I ask you what happened, a truthful response will be that you will tell me what happened but not why something happened. You know what
right.
happened? My car had a flat. I pulled over the side of the road, fixed it, and I got to work late. You don't need to explain anything. You just need to tell me what happened. When someone tells us what didn't happen, what wasn't said, what wasn't thought, we have a problem. But we have a worse problem if someone tells us why they did something. I didn't ask you why you did something. I asked what happened. When someone tells us why they did something, it is considered highly sensitive. And the word so, since, therefore, because is given the highest level of sensitivity indicators that we have in our system. We give it a blue marker, blue being the highest level of sensitivity. If we find in our paper one, two, or three color blues close together, we have a problem. We have the area of the utmost sensitivity for the person. And this is actually how murders are solved. In the O.J. murders, as he talked about what happened that day, in the analysis, if you hold up his paper, you can see the actual time of death just by judging by the color blues. You can see what triggered him. Everything is there. So it's really a neat indicator. But just in layman's terms, if I ask you what happened and you explain to me why it happened, that's beyond the boundary of the question of what happened. Something is wrong. So she said, so that evening, when he picked me up from work, we got home.
Oh. What
does that mean? Yeah.
What does that mean?
But listen to the whole sentence. It's really strange. And see if you can pick up what's going on with this, because when you can't pick up something, you can't figure it out. There's a reason. It doesn't make sense to you. It doesn't make sense to me. It makes sense to her. We have to enter her world. So that evening, when he picked me up from work, we got home. We were getting ready for bed. So it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and then she says, so, since, therefore, because of this, because she left at 3 o'clock, he came pick me up from work. We got home. We don't expect you to go anywhere else. We were getting ready for bed. Billy Dunn uses an expression, straight home, sometimes. When Billy Dunn says that she went straight anywhere, it means there was a stop someplace else. It's one of those her language things that picks up in her code.
So this
is really kind of an awkward thing. So that evening when he picked me up from work, we got home. We were getting ready for bed. Okay. Now, she's jumped over a period of time there. That's pretty well. She's
gone
from 3 o'clock to being picked up at probably 5 or 6. We got home. We were getting ready for bed.
Yeah,
nothing about dinner. The clock has obviously jumped ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So, we'd like to know, does she maybe work, 3 p.m. to 10 p.m. or something like that? No, she worked a regular 9-to-5 type of job, 8-to-4 job, so that wasn't the case. So that doesn't explain how bizarre this is. But what we do is we notice, remember what I said to you, when we ask you to tell us what happened, you should tell us what happened and not why, but you shouldn't tell us what didn't happen, what wasn't said, what wasn't thought. So if you said to me what happened, and I said to you, what happened? I didn't see anybody run across my driveway. You scratch your head and say, did someone run across your driveway? Why are you telling me that? It just sounds awkward to the untrained ear. But it's pretty simple. If you ask me what happened, if I tell you what didn't happen, something is very wrong. If I tell you what I didn't think, something is wrong. That's where you get the indication this person is telling a story that is not real. So she says, the girl said, let my mom know. So that evening when he picked me up from work.
Let me just interrupt for a minute. If she said, my mom, tell my mom, but didn't she have the cell phone that her mom specifically gave her? This is one of the questions we had from someone in the chat room. Specifically gave her that phone to contact her.
Yeah, there's some inconsistencies. These are some of the holes that end up in the story. We'll get to that phone issue.
Okay, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. It's actually helpful. Because otherwise it becomes too much of a monotone for me as I go through this.
Okay.
Because I can jump up and down and really excited saying, did you see that? Did you see that? And maybe no one else sees what I'm looking at. And I'm kind of a crazy person doing this. Well, basically, this is the point. If I ask you what happened, you should tell me what happened, not what didn't happen, not what wasn't said. When someone tells you what didn't happen, what wasn't said, what wasn't thought, you better be on your guard for deception and storytelling. So she said, we got home, we were getting ready for bed. When someone mentions getting ready for bed, we always note that they're telling us they went to bed, but they didn't tell us they went to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really important. She's not. It means, if I said, I'm getting ready for bed, and then I never tell you I went to sleep, it means I want you to think I went to sleep, but I didn't tell you that. And this is where we ask people, mm-hmm. listen to what Billy Dunn told you. She said, when he picked me up from work, we got home, we were getting ready for bed. The next wording was, I didn't get worried when I didn't hear from Haley. So she's supposed to tell us what happened, what was said, what was thought. Instead, she's now telling us what she didn't think. This is indication of storytelling. I didn't get
okay.
worried when I hadn't heard from her. We didn't ask you to
mm-hmm.
get worried.
Mm-hmm.
I thought you got married, Bess. This is where someone's repeating a story, trying to convince us it's true. I was kind of upset that she didn't call and confirm it with me, but not worried at that point. Okay, so she didn't get worried, and she kind of did get worried, and she's going back and forth. Tuesday, I was at work again. I left my cell phone at home for my kids to use when I'm working. Now, this
right.
is really interesting. What's really important to her is that she wants you to know that Monday, she went missing while I was at work. Tuesday, I was at work again. That's how she starts. She wants to make sure that she is far from that home. This is the alibi building. I left my cell phone at home for my kids to use. This is, I'm telling you not what I did, but why I did it when I'm working. So, Tuesday, I called my son. I said, tell Haley, text the little girl, her friend, tell Haley she needs to go ahead and get home. This was around lunch. My son called back within a few minutes, and she said, and he said, Mom, she said Haley never made it over there. She never spent the night, which we know is redundant. She never made it over there. She never spent the night. If she didn't make it over, she didn't spend the night. When someone repeats that which is not necessary to repeat, they have a reason to repeat it. They're trying to drive it home. So at that point, I called Haley's dad and found out she didn't go over there, didn't stay the night with him. I left from work and went to the police station in Colorado City and reported her missing. This is why we didn't have a 911 mm-hmm. call that. So by itself, she was just asked what happened. In this, she told us that Haley is dead, she needs an alibi, and there's a problem with her boyfriend, and there are indications that she's telling a story. So this 3 o'clock thing is a story according to the language.
Yes.
We have to look and see if this is her story or this is Sean Atkins' story that she's repeating. And I think probably in the chat room they want to know that. Well, if I tell you a lie and you repeat it, your language will not show that you're lying. In order to be deceptive, you have to have an intent to deceive. And that's what gets picked up in the language. So if I made up a story and I said, my car is blue, and you went around saying Peter's car is blue, and my car is not blue, it's green, you're not lying, you're just repeating someone else's words. You're entering into my language. I'm the one responsible for the lie. Well, in this case, about the story, she's not telling us that this is what Sean said. She's reporting these things as her own, and the language that she's choosing is deceptive.
Yeah.
So her communication language is deceptive. She goes outside the bounds of the question. She's redundant. And then she tells us what emotions she didn't have. This is what people do when they're telling a story. For instance, if someone said to you, let me tell you what happened to me. I was walking along the woods, and it started to get dark, and my heart was pounding in my chest. It was racing. That is an indication of a fabrication. The reason being is the inclusion of emotions in the middle perfect part of a story like that is something that storytellers do, but not what people do in real life. It takes
uh-huh.
time for us as humans. We take time to process our emotions. So
right.
after I told you I made it to the woods, then I go back and recount, you know, while I was there, my heart was pounding like crazy. Because
right.
That part of the story, I'm safe now, and now it's okay to talk about my emotions.
Yes.
So when someone gives
that
you their emotions.
That is so true.
Yeah. When they give their emotions like this way out that way, they're storytelling. Even a kid in the second grade knows, as I was walking through the woods, my heart was pounding, they're about to hear a story. Or they hear the word normal. Sean Atkins was asked, what was it like at 3 o'clock? And he said, it was normal. Even a once upon a time story, when someone says, and the day started out like any other day, it's a signal this is going to be something different than any other day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When I woke up, it was a normal Wednesday like any Wednesday. It's telling you this Wednesday is going to be something weird. Even kids in storytelling know that it's storytelling, and that's how it can be recognized as such. So, in question, is there hope for Haley?
Yes.
Today?
Is there?
No, there's no hope. She's dead, if you're listening to the mother. Later on, man, the time is flying, so I'm kind of cautious. I wanted to talk about the matter.
Right. I want to talk about why no arrests have been made, and we have some questions from the chatters.
Okay. I wanted to do it this way because I wanted people to see that this is not Peter Hyatt's opinion on what happened. This is simply listening to the mother, just listening to let her guide us with her words. I got to tell you, she used some chilling language that tells me that she saw that dead body. She wouldn't touch it.
Mm.
The next morning, she said, I looked in at 6 o'clock, and it looked like she was laying in bed. Wasn't that she looked in and she saw her? You might say if you couldn't see your child, yeah, she was laying in bed. It was dark, but she was laying in bed. It looked like she was laying in bed, but I didn't go in and touch her. Who would say
oh,
such a
wow.
thing?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Mm. What she does is she tells the truth even while she's deceiving.
Mm-hmm.
She introduced to Auntie Grace, first she mentioned anxiety medication. Hmm. The missing child, we have a bad boyfriend, and we have the introduction of anxiety medicine. And then she said she had a toothache. She had medicine for a toothache. Now she's introduced the topic of narcotics. And so I had written when this first came out that drugs are part of this case, and it's about to get a lot worse. And I drove straight home, she said. Instead of saying, I drove straight home. For Billy Dunn, it's a signal she's telling a lie. Nope. For her,
mm-hmm.
driving straight home meant going to the ATM, taking out money, going to her mother's, saying, Mom, do you need drugs? Her mother's in jail now for drugs. And then going to the local drug dealer to buy drugs, which she did. And she told Nancy
wow.
Grace, the drugs I had were prescribed to me. And Nancy Grace didn't buy it. She said, she caught on. So they were something that was once prescribed to you, but you went and got a refill from a drug dealer.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it just this is her pattern of deception. Well, her heavy pronoun use and her instinctive lying, her either or, her hedging of language suggests that this woman is a sociopath who has been lying from childhood and where she was sexually exploited, her words, put out as a prostitution, as a child prostitute, later on became a stripper. These are things that she has acknowledged to people. Okay. Invited in this man, we have drugs, child pornography, bestiality, bloodlust, serial killers, and we learn, remember the girl's case that Nancy Grace mentioned the first time?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When she was asked about the serial killer literature, she said, no, I printed out things. I never read them, but I printed them out that were from your website that you were associated with, and I didn't read them, but then I read them later. You know, she was lying about having read them, having not read them, having watched them, having not watched the videos. She
all
did
right.
watch the videos. She did read. She was lying. She got this story from that website, from Nancy Grace's own website, and thought she could get away with it.
Oh.
And that's where it came from. Now, this is, I know it's getting late, but the she's back on. After all this came out, she just blew everything, and the police affidavit came out. They found out that Billy Dunn once tried to have him arrested because he threatened to kill Haley, and then she moved him back in the house. Then the bestiality, the child pornography, all this came out. Now she's back on Facebook. She's not saying, I broke up with Sean Atkins. She said, he's not been an issue for months. My man now, she won't give his name, but my man she talks about, and she's pretending to have a type of fight, and she's afraid of Sean Atkins. It's a crock. And this is what I'll tell you listeners.
Yeah.
If she was afraid of Sean Atkins, and her followers were all waiting for the big day when she finally tells police Sean did it and gives up the information, it ain't going to happen. And here's why. Billy Dunn loves Billy Dunn more than anything else. Yes. Dr. Lillian Glass correctly identified Haley was a rival to Billy. Mm-hmm. Billy is immature, and I mean in a clinical sense. She's stuck, and this is why she dresses like an inappropriate 15-year-old. She's stuck as a teenager. She's aging rapidly due to the lifestyle, the drugs, the smoking, and everything else. So she's aging in a very difficult for her to digest manner. She's not becoming a lovely woman. She looks like she dresses trampy. She dresses inappropriately, dresses trying to be young. And she looks like a haggard old woman who's becoming bitter. Well, Dr. Lillian Grass identified that Haley was a rival. Haley was pretty. Haley was young. And Sean, who's younger than Billy, this is what is believed. The grandmother believed that Sean had raped Haley and then killed her to keep her quiet, and Billy was covering for him. I don't think so.
No.
I think they both did it. No, there is too much we. There's too much the use of the pronoun we when it comes to her and Sean Atkins.
Yeah.
And people who were hoping that she was going to throw him under the bus, forget it. Okay, she was involved in this. That mixture of child pornography, what that is, that's sexual arousal with children. That's used to desensitize Haley. The drugs would desensitize Haley. Sean Atkins told the police Haley was promiscuous at age 13. I personally believe, and no one has been arrested, no one's been prosecuted, it is my personal belief that Billy Dunn lost her temper when she saw Sean sexually molesting Haley, who may have been passive in resistance because of drugs,
mm-hmm.
and lost her temper and was involved in killing her, and then had Sean dispose of the body the next day, and then made up the story right from her serial killer library how to cover it up. I don't think the death was intentional, but it was due to neglect and then later on of violence and anger, because she invited him in, she invited the drug world in, she invited him in the world of sexual perversion.
Right.
Drugs.
His cousin. Yeah.
Yeah. Drugs, perversion, these things do not mix. She is in deep enough into this crime that she can't throw him under the bus because he has the information that can prove that she was just as involved. He told us this. This is not something that I'm making up. Billy Dunn, he said, the police asked him, who should we look at with this? And he said, look at both of us.
No way,
both
really?
Yeah, and this is what happens. People like this, they do brag. The reason that Billy Dunn kept coming back on Nancy Grace show is not just the love of the narcissistic love of attention, but she is a truly deceptive sociopath who, like Scott Peterson and others, love to control information. And if you think that they're a liar, you trigger such angry feelings in them. Her denials of jealousy, because this was addressed on one of the programs, I think it was 7th or 8th program, her denials show deception and show sensitivity. She was jealous of Haley, of Haley's future and the life that Haley was going to have. Haley wasn't much younger than Billy Dunn when Billy Dunn was first pregnant. Her life was derailed.
Mm.
So this is a sociopath who is pulling the wool over a small group of people's eyes, who is looking for more attention now, coming out of the woodwork, and feigning that she's afraid of Sean Atkins. I've got to tell you, I think Sean Atkins is probably afraid of her.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, she was the brains of the operation. She's the one that kept on going back. When they wanted him to take a polygraph, he stormed out twice. She convinced them they could do it. She got him high. They both showed up high as a kite. And they weren't allowed to take him because they were high. This tells us she had a need to fool the polygraph.
Mm-hmm.
And then his family tried to keep her away, and they believed that Sean was innocent, so they had Sean take his own polygraph. They paid for it themselves, the private polygraph. He failed that, too. And so what the town manager had said was 2 + 2 = 4. You have a missing 13-year-old. You have failed polygraphs. You have drugs. You have sexual perversion. What do you think it adds up to, people? And the reaction from the Hope for Haley people was just rage and anger. There are people that, if Billy Dunn were to confess this crime, who would still say, we love you anyway, Billy. We'll bite you in prison. It wasn't really your fault. And they always blame someone else. Billy Dunn blames everyone for everything.
And it sounds like including Haley.
Oh, yes. Oh, she definitely targeted her. But she even blamed people for things that, for not answering questions that she didn't even ask them. And this is where Nancy Grace became really frustrated. She said, Billy, did you ask Sean where he went after he went to his mother since he was caught in a lie? And she said, I haven't had a chance to. And then Nancy Grace said, I'm asking this one again. And she said, well, I don't talk with him. And said, well, you must communicate somehow. And Billy said, well, he texts me every few days. And then she lied about that. She kept getting caught lie after lie. Nancy Grace tagged her each time. And it just came out to the point where Mark Klass had gone to Texas, had met with her, said he admired her. Yeah, the police told me that he was coaching her how to speak and how not to be caught in lies, which infuriated them. Then he looked like an idiot because he had to go later on, after the child pornography and the lies came out, he had to go and publicly call upon shame upon Billie Jean's name because of it. So the emphasis is upon Billie Jean in this murder case, when the emphasis should be on the two of them. The reason that she is the target of the analysis is because she's done all the talking.
Mm-hmm.
He never said he didn't kill her. He said things like he would never, but he's never been able to bring himself to say, I didn't kill her, and we're not going to say it for him.
Mm-hmm.
But she is the one that was front and center. She's the one that wanted attention, and now she's saying that she wants attention again. And I got to tell you, she's going to get it. If she wants
she
to
will.
Speak publicly, yeah, people are going to listen. There isn't a single crime analyst in this country that anyone can find, because I haven't, and everyone I know hasn't, that said, no, Billie Jean Dunn and Sean Atkins are innocent. No, they're not involved. You don't need training and statement analysis to know that you're being lied to when someone like that lies.
Mm-hmm.
She deflects. She distracts. She uses that either-or language constantly. She qualifies everything. She leaves herself wiggle room for a lot of things. She's like the person that says, I heard the gun go off. It's a truthful statement. She's just not telling you she pulled the trigger.
Mm-hmm.
So she leaves out that information. Each place she left out information, Nancy Grace revisited on the following program and found out, oh, that was what was missing, or this was what was missing.
Yeah.
So I think they're both responsible for the death of Haley.
Well, that is very interesting. I didn't think of it like that. But, Peter, let's take some questions. I wanted to get to the why no arrests have been made. Boy, I hate to hear the answer to that. But, first of all, Boston Lady, and by the way, if we run a little long, I think we're going to go ahead and just continue with this for a few minutes after. Anybody listening can listen to the program in its entirety, even what you miss here tonight, and you will be able to hear it in archives. Okay. Boston Lady was the gal who did make that comment about her cell phone if she left it home with the kids to get in touch with her. But instead, Haley waits to tell Sean. Now, we got to that one. But Boston Lady also is asking, will Haley ever be found, do you think? I mean, somebody else had said, deer season has come and went. Nothing was found.
I don't know, but I hope. I hope that remains to be found, that someone walking someplace. There is a concern, and this was raised, that Sean Atkins had access to acid.
Uh-oh.
And and he talked about, when he was asked, when she was missing, someone asked him about killing a child, and he said, it's just like killing a deer or gutting a deer. he was into that whole blood and guts and Chainsaw Massacre type of stuff. So for him, it was not really much of a stretch. I worry that he used the acid and was able to reduce her remains pretty dramatically. So when about the arrest, this is how I understand it. The a number of people had access to the different computers, which makes it very difficult to decide which one to charge for which child pornography. So it's like at a standstill. But the problem with the arrest is this, is that they have to believe they have enough to get a conviction now, because if they go for a conviction and blow it, there's no second chance. There's no double jeopardy. And so that makes, I think, people overly cautious. I think they should have made an arrest on the child pornography. I think if they had done that, I think they would have gotten an admission or confession out of Sean Atkins, he's the weaker of the two, and they would have had the remains found already. So I think that the prosecutor should have pulled the trigger, but they have information that we don't, and at some point we have to have an element of trust saying they know what they're doing. It's frustrating, but we have to trust in that.
Mm-hmm. It is. It's frustrating. Okay, a couple of the other questions. Tony, I guess Billie Jean had a tattoo of Haley on her left arm, and he's wondering why. I didn't hear that.
Yeah, it's true. I have a picture of it.
It reminds me of Casey Anthony with the
Bella Vita. Yes.
Yeah.
Tony, I think it was a memorial. I think that that's what she did. She thinks it looks good on her, and she thinks it makes her look innocent. She does whatever helps her appearance. People that are sociopaths in particular, but highly deceptive people, are very, very concerned about their reputation. And if you challenge them and say that they're a liar, you will incur their wrath. They will go after you. Haley's own grandmother said Sean raped and killed her, and Billy had nothing to say to that. When I said the same thing, she got a lawyer and said she was going to sue me. Now, she could decide to sue me, which is fine, because there are lawyers that are straining at the bit to jump in, because you'll have to prove the things I've said are not true. She'll have to take the stand. It would be a disaster, obviously.
Right.
It was an interesting case when her lawyer was on television saying he was going to sue me. He called me a fool publicly, and then he went ahead and pulled a gun on a Texas Ranger while he was coked up trying to meet with the Texas Ranger's wife, and got himself arrested and had to go to rehab and that sort of thing. So it would be interesting to ask him what his definition of the word fool is in his own internal dictionary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have fun with that one.
Another question we have is Boston ladies wondering if Ellie can ever prosecute without a body. Well, we know that there have been successful cases with that, but they have to have a much stronger case than they have now.
See, I think they have a very strong case now, even without a body. The circumstantial evidence, they can submit to a jury the interviews that would take place, not the results of the polygraph, but the interviews. I think they have more than enough. They don't feel the same way as I do, but I think the circumstantial evidence is very powerful. They have this combination. What can be done, which was just done recently, is that without a body and without an actual proving of a murder, is a woman has just been found guilty of child endangerment. She reported her child missing. Police knew that she was lying. It was like a baby Isla, baby Lisa case, like a Haley case and other cases, where they had a successful prosecution over a child endangerment charge instead of homicide or a kidnapping charge.
Uh-huh.
And the mother got 10 years. So if you don't think you have enough for the murder charge, and a defense attorney is going to try to convince, like Cindy Anthony, convince the jury that a shred of doubt exists that maybe Haley is alive, like they said the KB was alive, this would go against that. So don't go for that she's dead. Go for child endangerment, and that could work out.
That could work out. And another question from Tony. Peter, do you still believe Haley is around us? This question is from Tony. He's asking, Peter, do you still believe Haley is around a 50-mile radius?
I do. I'm certain the fact that he was not able to go back and move those remains, that they are someplace where he dropped off in that area there. And I know it's like finding a needle in a haystack, but I believe that's where she is, and that's where the sensitivity of the responses came from. So, yeah, I do.
What about the hotel? Did they ever find, I know the dogs, the bloodhounds tracked to this hotel. Did they ever find any camera footage, anything?
Nothing.
I don't know. I couldn't find that. I couldn't find the answer to that.
Yep, no, there was nothing there. And in fact, the police found out, and one told me this particularly, that the people that said they saw Haley, upon later questioning, they were either stoned or out of their minds. They were unreliable, involved in drugs, wanting to be friend with Billy Dunn. There was no reliable sighting of Haley. My own belief was Haley was not even alive that day. Haley was a corpse when Billy Dunn looked in. I mean, can you imagine saying of your 13-year-old daughter, I looked into her room, it looked like she was lying in bed, but I didn't touch her. Not only do we have that which is reported in the negative, what someone didn't do, but we also have the bizarre didn't touch her. And then she also, in that sentence, she included her emotions. So there were three signals of deception in that statement. I think that she is actually being truthful in the deception. It's truthful that she did not enter the room. It's truthful that Haley looked like she was laying there. Imagine that, looked like she was laying there. Not looked like she was sleeping, looked like she was laying there.
Yeah.
And I believe that the mother did not go in and touch her either.
Mm-hmm.
So there are frightening things that she said, and I think it was on the fourth appearance of Nancy Grace show, fourth appearance, that was just chilling. Like someone describing it. If you listen to her words and think she's describing a body, it fits. If you think she's describing a living person, it doesn't fit. And this is why we say it doesn't make sense to us, but it makes sense to them. It's out of chronological order to us, but not to them, not to the deceiver.
Right. Very interesting, Peter. Boy, we have gone over our time. We've gotten some questions answered. I'm telling you, we had the best guests in the chat room tonight. These guys really have some great questions and great chatter going on in the chat room.
They're people that are really passionate about this case, and
they want to see
Sean Atkins and Billie Jean Dunn brought to justice. They want to see justice for Haley. So they're not going with the bumper sticker mentality, hope for Haley, hope for Haley. They're saying justice for Haley, and I'm with them.
Yeah, I'm with them, too.
It's a time for sober-minded thinking.
Yes, exactly. Well, I guess we'll wrap it up for tonight, Peter. Thank you for co-hosting with me tonight. It's always a pleasure having you. I enjoy it so much. I get so wrapped up in everything you're saying, and I usually just sit here with my mouth open. So I would like to thank the public relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be on Tuesday, September 18th, when my co-host will again be Crime Wire consultant and statement analyst Peter Hyatt. Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the CrimeWire team. This is Kim Colton and Peter. Thank you and good night. Thank you, Peter. And thank you, everyone, who gave us such great input. Good night.